Thank you, Mr. President. Much of my recent life, I've been addressing people as Mr. President. I sort of got the idea for a while. Mr. Mortensen and my good friend Russell Fridley and Bob Wheeler is with us here tonight, and Jim Pedersen, and all of the dignitaries that have been so honored here by the baptismal ceremony. And I don't mean me, I mean that I was your agent. By the way, it's pretty good juice that was in that jug. I don't know whether it's what they said it was, but I've never tasted grapes that good before. I'm so happy to see my old friend Fred Manford, because we could make this quite a historical occasion. Fred and myself were students together over at the university. We were part of the original Hunger program back in those days. And it's good to see him here tonight. And it's particularly good to know that our society, the Minnesota Historical Society, is presided over and has as its president one of the distinguished Minnesotans and a very dedicated public servant, the former governor of this state, Elmer Anderson. We're very honored that he has taken on this responsibility. Now, let me say to Mr. Mortensen, and if I could introduce people like you can, I might have been president. Really, when he went up and down this table, it was like a symphony orchestra director just bringing out the best all the time. Everything was beautiful harmony. And I could just see people just getting up and starting a sort of draft Mortensen movement for whatever year he wants. But I noted down, and he started to speak. He said, "Many of you are here by the grace of God and election." I thought I heard the word election at least. "Well, I want you to know that I'm here by the grace of the electorate and the Constitution. Or I might not have been here. And I'm not so sure, but what I'm a very fortunate man in many ways." Well, I've jotted down a lot of notes about history, like my Model T Ford, which I could talk about tonight. And there is the old classic cars are on display in that other city, the city that I once served as mayor in Minneapolis. I trust that some of you have gotten over there too. And I could talk to you about my Model A Ford that makes less noise than a high-priced Swiss watch. It's a beautiful car. It was sold to me by none other than Jim Pedersen, who is here at the Minnesota Historical Society. He's quite an entrepreneur, I might say. He understands the profit and loss statement, and especially profit. I qualify somewhat as a speaker tonight by having been a member of the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian, and that, of course, that great institution represents, I think, some of the best of our museum and some of the best of our historical collection, if not the best. So I'm, and also I minored in history at the university. But as I used to say to many of the people that I was talking to when I was politicking, that it's much better to make history than it is to read it. But sometimes if you read it, you have a better chance of making it. And sometimes if you sense it, you may be able to contribute to it. And I think that's what this is all about here tonight. This great association, and what a fine group it is. You represent people all over this great land of ours that are deeply interested in our heritage. But you're the custodians, you're the stewards, you're the leaders, and all of us are indebted to you. So I believe that on behalf of the public, that I can express for that American public tonight our thanks to those of you here from the state and local associations and societies that have conserved for posterity a little bit of Americana, a little bit of what made things happen in the communities that you represent or that you tonight symbolize. and I want to thank you. Now, the President of the United States is a very busy man. And while there's nothing in our history or in our background or tradition that says that the man that was defeated should take on certain responsibilities, I am carving out a new niche for defeated candidates, namely to go to meetings that the main man can't get to and express his thanks and his appreciation. Well, you know, you did make it difficult for us here tonight. When my wife was introduced, you all stood and applauded. It'll take me another week to get Muriel back and to where I had her before she came in this room tonight. I must say that Mr. Mortensen has not improved the situation at all by his extra attention to Muriel. I'll hear about this later on. But Mr. Mortensen, I'll get even with you, so help me, I'll wait my time. I asked Mr. Fridley and Mr. Pedersen what I might talk about here tonight. And they said, well, we want you to prepare a very, very impressive and important document. Well, I'm happy to tell you that I've been on vacation. And so have you. So I'm not going to make any such presentation. You'll have to invite me back for another day. But I did get some questions that were given to me in a letter a little over a page long. In one paragraph, four little items that I might want to direct my attention towards. And I'm going to do that tonight with slight variations. And it'll be undoubtedly the variations that'll take most of the time. But that'll be the time that I enjoy the most. John Stuart Mill was one of my heroes as a political philosopher and a political economist. John Stuart Mill once said, "Let a man have nothing to do for his country, and he shall have no love for it." As I sat here tonight pondering that phrase, and it just flashed through my mind as I was sitting here, I thought I would paraphrase it because I think it applies to what we are trying to do in this association. Let a man be ignorant of what his forebears have done for his country, and he shall have little love or respect for it. You cannot live on current events. It's far too intoxicating and toxic a diet. And particularly in the day and age of the news broadcast every 15 minutes, and the day and the age of the picture on the television, and the several editions of the morning and the afternoon newspaper with all of the variations. If there's any one thing that I try to tell my students, it is that if you're only interested in current events, go get yourself a World's Almanac. Because the only way that you can have any hope for the future is to have some knowledge of the past. Because history gives perspective. And history also generates tolerance, it generates patience, and it generates understanding. I am convinced that much of the difficulty today in American society, as well as around the world, is due to the fact that we are so inundated with this tidal wave of information and current events made possible by modern communication and media that we've lost our bearing, so to speak. We are not quite sure from whence we came or where we're going. We're storm-tossed on the sea of contemporary events rather than being able to set our sights to the stars and knowing where our goal and our objective may be. Now, this is my view of it, and every man, when he occupies a podium like this, of course, exercises his right of point of view. I'm not sure that I'm right, but this is at least one of my observations. I do believe that it is much better to make history than it is to read it or study it, but I believe with equal fervor, as I said just a little earlier, that you'll really not be able to make much that is worthy of being called history unless you have a sense of history, unless you have a feeling of it. And it's with those early observations that I want to direct myself now to the questions that were, or the issues that were posed by Mr. Peterson and Mr. Fridley and others in their letter to me. The first proposition that was stated is, to what extent is a man who makes history influenced by history? Or how has your knowledge of history influenced your career? Well, one has to be slightly immodest to place himself in the channels of history. But tonight I will indulge, as I frequently do, in that kind of immodesty. My friends will not be surprised, and others might just as well become accustomed to it. Well, every young man, I would hope, sort of romanticizes about his life. This is one thing that parents can do for their youngsters, to give them a sense of importance, a feeling of greatness, even if it's only in their imagination. I guess that my interest in public affairs was generated in a family that was proud of its books, and particularly by a father that was very well read in biography. I've had many people say to me in recent years, particularly, "Well, Mr. Humphrey, what books have you read of late?" This is particularly true when you get into highly sophisticated society where there is a sort of genteel matching of wits, a sort of a way to put you in your place, and particularly if you're in public life, because people in public life are frequently looked upon as a rather unusual breed that need to have a kind of enforced humility. And when you're vice president, believe me, you have it both by the Constitution and practice and tradition. Well, my father taught me to read biography. And I read The Boy's Life of Edison, The Boy's Life of Lafayette, The Boy's Life of practically everybody that ever lived, it seemed like, as a youngster. And I romanticized in my life about the knights of old and how a young man's mind can wander and how he can just dream of that he's a truly great figure. But I think this is as important for a youngster, particularly when he's in that impressionable period of his life in adolescence, as any experience that will come to him. And I recall that as a very young man, I was taught by teacher and father about Woodrow Wilson. Now, I am one of the finest things that's happened to me in my public life, and one of the final acts, public acts, of the former president, Mr. Johnson, was to be appointed, that he appointed me as chairman of the Board of Regents of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, which was commissioned by an act of Congress in October 1968 and will become a truly advanced institute of advanced studies institute on international relations and American government. It will become a university of universities. It's in its first year now, and in the year of 1970, we will have the first 40 or 50 scholars coming to this country from all over the world, having at their fingertips access to the archives of our government, to the departments of government, to the great universities and advanced study institutes, to learn and to teach, to study and to tell about international relations, domestic policy, American government, to learn more about these United States. So one of my boyhood dreams has been realized, namely to have some identification with Woodrow Wilson. But the Woodrow Wilson that I remember was the Woodrow Wilson of the League of Nations. We were talking here tonight about somebody had was printed in the Minnesota Historical Society bulletin about my interest in international relations even as a student at the University of Minnesota. And in 1939 and 1940, when there was a bitter struggle going on in this country as to whether or not there should be a program of aid to the Allies, and particularly aid to Britain in those difficult and tragic moments of the Battle of Britain. And there was a divided America. And I was one of the young men at that time that said, yes, we must aid. And I came from South Dakota, isolationist country. And I've had many people ask me since, how come that you could grow up in Minnesota and South Dakota, born and raised in South Dakota, your higher education in Minnesota, the center of isolationism in the United States, and still be an advocate of international cooperation, foreign assistance, foreign aid, and subsequently an advocate and a strong advocate of the United Nations? I said, because my political hero in my adolescence, in my teenage period, in my college, early college days, was Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, the man of peace. Woodrow Wilson, the man of vision. Woodrow Wilson, who gave his life in that cross-country tour as he fought for the League of Nations. Woodrow Wilson, who had a vision. And I still believe to this day that had we listened to his voice, had we followed his advice, we may have been spared the carnage of World War II. At least it's my opinion. So a man's life, a political hero, had an impact on my life. My second political hero and more contemporary was Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was the man that I had the privilege of casting, for whom I had the privilege of casting my first vote. I'll never forget it. I felt as you, Mr. Mortensen, that I was really striking a blow for freedom, that I was really taking a stand, because there will never be an experience in my life that was as meaningful in terms of its impact upon my thinking as the Depression. And the breakdown, at the almost at least, breakdown of our system. As I tell young Americans today, this system hasn't broken down today. It's troubled, it's corroded at times, it's even corrupted, but it still works. I grew up at a time when the system ground to a halt, when the poor were not just the indigenous poor that had always been poor, but the poor were people who once were men and women of substance, of wealth, of middle income, of property, and they were struck down as if they had been rolled over by a mighty tidal wave. I think that that part of history has left its impact on me and surely has conditioned my politics. I will never be able to forget it. And I know that out of those days, experiences came to mind, experiences that I recall that helped shape legislation later on. The Job Corps. I was its original author in the Congress of the United States because I remembered the Civilian Conservation Corps. And I remembered the young men that walked the railroad tracks in the days of the Depression. And I remember that many of them were considered to be useless and worthless by some of their more fortunate contemporaries, only to have them become generals and colonels and congressmen and governors and businessmen and labor people and labor leaders and professors. I have not forgotten. It left a tremendous impact on me. I also can remember the biting, sarcastic criticism of the works of the WPA, and how some people stood in judgment of their fellow men and their fellow citizens and called them ne'er-do-wells, said they were lazy, said they were no worthless, and they were the subject of ridicule. And where are they today? Many of them are men and women of great economic strength and wealth, people of culture. In fact, the best art that this country has had, the best in art, came out of the WPA art project, without a doubt. Without that kind of Without that program, many a courthouse and many a post office and many a federal building which ought to represent the people's art would have nothing but concrete and brick. Today, there's at least an expression of the soul of America that came from people who could interpret the life of this nation. And interestingly enough, they didn't interpret it with bitterness. They interpreted it with hope. Take a look at those murals that were painted. Take a look at some of the fine artwork of that day, and you'll see not a tortured mind, but you'll see a mind that was filled with hope and with confidence about this country and this world in which we live. So I guess it's fair to say that the knowledge of history, or that history surely can influence a man in his public utterances and his public life. I recall, for example, that my recollection of history is of the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, just to be a little more mundane. Ever since that day, because I think that that act had something to do with bringing America to her economic knees and of touching off a worldwide depression, ever since then, I have been a man that has advocated not just reciprocal trade, but ever more freer trade, because I believe that when nations trade without these impediments and barriers, that we become more civilized and we become at least more reasonable in our approach to the problems that beset us. Well, I could talk far too long about that, and I shall not. Now, the second question that was posed to me was, how have the figures of political power that you have known been influenced by the study of history? Well, it's difficult to answer that, because one would have to have a very intimate insight or intimate knowledge of the life of a person that you know, or an insight into his experiences. But I happen to know that this man that was oftentimes looked upon as less than an intellectual, and frequently the subject of bitter criticism, and now a national hero, Harry Truman, President Truman, was a student of history, and particularly American history, and particularly the presidency of the United States. Little did people know that Harry S. Truman, as county judge, as citizen, and United States Senator, was a profound student of the presidency of the United States. This was a hobby of his. And when he became president, he understood how to be president. History conditioned him, and he had a sense of history. I'm sure that no man in our time had a greater sense of history than that charismatic, brilliant young man, John Kennedy. From his earliest days as a student in England, when his father was ambassador there, to his days in the Senate, and to his writings that we recall, and then to the presidency, he had a sense of history. And he was always capable of reciting or quoting from the greats of America and the world, because he was a student, not only of literature, but of biography, of events. I remember how he used to say, when people would ask about how things were going and whether or not he could endure the struggle and the strain of office, he said it always reminded him of that man in the French Revolution who was asked, "What did you do during the revolution?" And the old Frenchman said, "I survived." Well, most of the time, a president is so beset with problems, strain, and tension that he is lucky if he can survive. Adlai Stevenson was an intimate friend of mine. And Stevenson was a student of Lincoln, a student of Americana, a student of American political history. And I'm just as sure as I look at this audience that part of his greatness was due to that knowledge. Besides that, Adlai Stevenson was the kind of man that sought out the nobility of history, the decency of it. That was his emphasis. And he lived that way. So history surely influenced his life. President Johnson, with whom I've had a very close association, was a detailed student of the Congress of the United States, which, by the way, is a shortcoming. The knowledge of the Congress is a tragic shortcoming in the higher education institutions of this land. Young people are brought up to have disdain and disrespect for Congress rather than respect. It's the most human institution of parliamentary government, by far. For one reason above all, it is representative. Secondly, that it requires self-discipline rather than imposed discipline. Other parliamentary institutions, you have to vote a certain way because you're a member of a party. And if your party loses a vote, your government goes out of power. If the Prime Minister of Great Britain lays down a policy and his party doesn't back him, he is no longer Prime Minister, and the Labour Party is out of government and out of power. In the United States of America, the President of the United States can be of the same party as the majority in Congress, and he has no authority whatsoever except persuasion and influence and personal relations over that Congress. And the caucus of a political party in the Congress has no binding authority over its members. So that the Congress of the United States becomes an instrument of self-discipline, if any discipline. And therefore it shows all of the human frailties, because how much self-discipline do any of us have? It seems to me that somewhere along the line we ought to start teaching American government like it is. I'm trying to do a little of that. I haven't really got around to it as much as I should like, but I will do more of it. Because this government, this country, is no better than its Congress. And if there's a fool or two there, just remember there are some of those in the electorate, and they're entitled to representation. Now let me digress for just a moment on a broader plane. I hope you're having as much fun about this as I am at the moment. Poor Mrs. Fridley, she's had a rough time up here because I've been bending her ear about my observations about the Soviet Union. You know, you get to be a great expert when you're quite a ways away from home. I don't claim to be any expert in the Soviet Union, but I've been there. Mrs. Humphrey and I have been there three times together, 1958, 1963, and 1969. But what I really wanted to tell you about it is the impact of the history of the Russian people upon whatever government is in charge of Russia. Mark my words, ladies and gentlemen, Russia's history is more impressive and has a greater impact upon what happens in Russia than does communism. Communism is a veneer over Russia. It's a tough one, but it is not the sum and substance of that land and its people. In World War II, when the Russians were driven back to the gates of Leningrad, Stalingrad, Moscow, Rostov, Odessa, what was the appeal to the people? Was it stand up and fight for Lenin? Was it the glory of Marx? Not on your life. It was stand and die for Mother Russia. Mother Russia. Very important. So to understand that great expanse of territory, that tremendous power that's there, this system that they have today, you have to understand the history of Russia. And really, in many ways, they've traded the czars for commissars. They've traded off the church for the Communist Party. They've traded off the princes for the ministers. And the bureaucracy of the present regime is very similar to the bureaucracy of the regimes of years and years ago. And Russia itself is very much the same, except for its technological advance, which is, of course, substantial, except for its tremendous program of literacy, for which the government of the Soviet Union is to be commended for its programs of health. But the temperament of the people is very much the same. Russia is not a bubbling stream coming out of the mountains. It is a slow-moving glacier. And thus it has always been. And you get a sense of history there as few other places. Because even with the mighty power of the police state, they can only do so much. The Russian peasant is still the backbone of that great land. And when they're in dire trouble, they depend upon him, and he's always been exploited, and he is even to this day. And yet he's the most loyal, as he was to the czars, so he is today to a new political system. They have never known freedom as we've known it in the Soviet Union, and therefore they possibly don't miss it as we would. They have new heroes, but they also have old ones. And I want to just leave this thought to you because it's a part of history. Peter the Great is the new national hero of the Soviet Union. I think there's something meaningful in this. At least this is my observation. I haven't heard anybody else make it, but it's worth at least one point of view and one man's voice. Today, the central issue that confronts the Soviet Union is the menace of China. This consumes their thought every day. And by the way, if you have a knowledge of history of Russia, the racial prejudice in that country is not about blacks, of which they have none, but Chinese. When Japanese are there in the recent tours, they wear a little pin, the rising sun, to differentiate themselves from what Russians might think was the Chinese. Why then do the Russians today seem to honor Peter the Great? Because Peter the Great was the man that opened the windows of Russia to the West. He was the man that traveled to England, to France, to Germany, to Holland, to the West. He was the man that said Russia must be westernized. And I think that I have had enough experience in political life to know that this is a rather subtle way of saying to the whole world, and particularly to the United States, that we know where our trouble is, and we're looking for friends, and we are identifying ourselves with a part of the world that is less menacing and more hopeful. A knowledge of history of the Russia, not just the Communist Party. The Communist Party is a recent development, but the 500, 600, 700 years of Russian history since the first walls of the Kremlin gives you some insight into what is Russia. And Russia is more than the USSR, which has become a communist, an identification with the communist ideology. Well, that's just a little thought I had. I think Khrushchev, by the way, was a student of history and was influenced by Russian history. He was a peasant. He was rugged and cunning. He was clever, politically sensitive. He represented that element in the Russian life that was of the sensitive element, of the artist, of the musician, of the literary genius, of the political genius. But those have been the luxuries of Russian life. He was too unpredictable, too emotional, too fast-moving for that slow, cautious, defensive, less than self-confident Russia. And Mr. Kosygin fits it better. He is quiet, thoughtful, methodical, managerial, much less given to explosive outbursts, reliable. They know what they have. And this fits the pattern. You see, the Soviet Union is the most unrevolutionary, revolutionary country on the face of the earth. Dynamic changes are few. Steady pressure is its pattern. Well, I think your knowledge of history gives you some insight in how you deal with these people. This is why some of us have said you must have infinite patience. And you must understand that decisions can be made promptly, quickly, without any apparent relevance to what transpired before. Except if you watch carefully, you can understand what's going to happen. Well, this is a topic within itself. I just thought I'd toss it out just for your consideration. Now, how important is a knowledge of history to a political figure of power? Well, I haven't had much power as a political figure, so I can't, you know what Humphrey's Law is relating to the vice presidency. You get whatever authority you have from the president, not from the Constitution. And the law is that he who giveth can taketh away. So you really don't have much power. You have occasionally a little lease on some power that somebody else had. But I think that a man in public life is the first person to understand that the word politics, even though it is derived from the Greek word that means community, and of course has interpretation to mean people, really is power. Now, a senator has a great deal of power without having the requirement of responsibility all the time for the use of that power. A vice president has a great deal of responsibility with no constitutional hold upon any degree of power. The president is the only person in government that has both power and responsibility. But a man in public life, in order to have any kind of influence or power, in order to get elected, I have been elected sometimes, and I know both the pleasures and the pains of victory and defeat. And before I forget it, let me tell you, there's nothing that you can learn in defeat that you can't learn better in victory. Well, how important is a knowledge of history to a political figure? I think it's terribly important. And by the way, there's something happening in our educational institutions now that is going to sharpen, I think, the political sensitivity of many of our people, our leaders in particular, and I hope the general citizenry. Ethnic studies.